Vision of Difference, I as Creator, with your host, Elondis Lake. Our search for unity starts within. Our quest for safety starts within. Once we understand the role difference plays when building community, we can release what we are holding back. We can learn from life's challenges. We can become who we are meant to be.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Illusion of Difference. My name is Elondis Lake, and I'm your host. We're looking at some interesting times and some disturbing times, and I'm hoping to be able to help as any way I can with some of the confusion in myself and others. Today I have my guest, Johnny, Dr. Johnny Lake, who will help me go through the maze of information. Mr. Lake, Dr. Lake, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is the second time we've come together, and in this way. And I'm excited about some of the things we might talk about. And one is toward the end of the other podcast, you raised white identified versus black identified. And that's where I'd like to start, because I see this in the context of several things. So one is just, is that a way of appropriating someone else's culture? Is that a new way of doing it? Or is it something else? And, so that is where I'd like to start, and then we can move down and tag it in different places.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested in hearing more about white identified and black identified, because that was kind of new to me.
Yeah. Well, race is a social construct.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing inherent in a person's skin color. Doesn't tell you if I run fast, jump high, play basketball, play football, if I got rhythm, can sing and dance. Doesn't tell you anything about me. Skin color of another person, if their skin is white, light enough to be considered white. It also, again, doesn't tell us anything about that person. So what has happened when we use terms like white and black is there's the conflation of race and culture.
Yes.
Now, culture is substantive. Culture is real in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Food practices, music, architecture, language, religion, all of these things are cultural aspects that get coded as racial aspects. So what is Chinese food? What is Mexican food? What is black music? What is white music? And if you look at these constructs critically, there's no race in music. There's no race invested in food. It's what we do to make it seem that race is actually substantive and real. And so when we take one step back and realize what we're doing, we have to recognize that race, separated from culture, has practically no meaning except what we give it in our heads and in our society.
And in our
hearts.
So
that's where stereotyping and bias and prejudice and discrimination all comes into effect, is in our heads. So in real estate, there's no difference in a black person owning a property versus a white person owning the property, except for the way that racism works.
Yeah.
And my grandma used to say, baby, the white man's ice is always colder than the black man's ice. And the white man's sugar is always sweeter than the black man's sugar. Now, she was an old black woman who only went to fourth grade, probably never read a book about white privilege or white male privilege or any of those things. But what did she see for 90 plus years of her life? That if a white person owns something, considered more valuable than if a black person owns something. So she was describing to me white male privilege without ever having used the term probably in 90 years.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So the benefits of racism, is really what hanging on to these racial categories are about, is the benefits of racism and the necessity to maintain racial categories so that we know who gets to enter whiteness and who does not, and who gets to benefit from whiteness and who does not.
So when someone says they're white identified or black identified, is that their way of I keep running into the appropriation word, where you're taking someone else's culture, because it is, like you laid it out very clearly, about culture more than anything else.
Yes, and culture.
What's the difference with
That's it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What's the difference with the identification? Black identified, white identified. What is different about that? Or is it? Is this just a new term that people have decided that they want to try and use?
A white man out of my audience. And I'll say, if this man grew up in Tennessee where I did, in the same household, with the same grandmother, with the same influences, the same experiences that I grew up with, would his culture be white or would his culture be black? And so, again, these are socially produced constructs, so we're not born with it. A child is born. A child don't know if they're white or if they're black. That gets learned through the social context in which they grow up in. And so when we look at culture and segregation, it was probably pretty easy to define people and their culture. Because blacks were over there, whites were over there, Native Americans over there, Latinos over there. And in many of our cities, you still see the same phenomenon. Where's the black part of town? People can point you there.
Yeah.
And so the overt segregation based on racial categories is what produced the idea that there's a difference in black people or white people. But in a multicultural context, which many of our children are growing up in, they pick up aspects of culture from each other. So it's like a lot of the children who like music. You see the white children playing black people's music as much as black kids are, maybe more, because they got money and resources to buy it. Mm-hmm. And so the integration of our society has produced what should be considered a positive, in fact, but also a multicultural context where our children can learn multiple cultures as they grow up. Like, the science shows that being bilingual actually makes your brain work more effectively, more efficiently.
It does.
And so I've met children who have two languages, three languages, four languages. One little girl I worked with in fifth grade, she spoke five languages at fifth grade and had no conflict with any of them.
That's the way
Looking forward rather than backwards, we really do need to provide multiple opportunities for our children to learn, and especially white children who their segregation, even though it's privileged, like I asked the audience the other day, how many people ever told you that being white and middle to upper class was going to be a disadvantage? Everybody looked puzzled. I said, has anybody told you that being white and middle to upper class was going to be a disadvantage? They said, no. I said, well, in a lot of these situations you will find yourself in as a teacher and a counselor, your upbringing would be one of your biggest disadvantages.
Yep.
Because you have been isolated so much from poor people and from people of color and from other people's lives that you are likely to be the most incompetent person in the room full of multicultural children who have grown up with each other.
And not only that, even just the education of the person focus on, and what they use as intellectual and professional references will be like one-sided or limited at the best.
Incredibly limited. Yes. Which is why
I think it might go for also not necessarily just white with the education. I'm just leaving it at that point. Education.
No.
There are, I don't think we can exactly put it into white black, because you can see where black people might run into but that same limitation going to the same colleges, and they would have to
come from the same schools, same influences, same measures of success. Everything else, you will find that people of color will sometimes be more resistive to change than white people, because they've discovered how to be successful in a white, dominant, white supremacist context. And so I often tell communities of color, if you think that white people are the only ones in our society who have a problem with race, you're making a huge mistake.
Yeah.
Because if the dominant culture has issues and concerns with race, then guess what? All of the non-dominant communities naturally have issues with race. So that the
exactly.
secondary manifestation of white supremacy in communities of color often result in the same kind of divisions and same kind of conflicts within communities of color.
Mm.
So
mm.
having a PhD, you know this story, having higher education, a PhD in black communities don't necessarily help you that much.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
It might, mm-hmm. like I said, even separate you from what
it
you
will
need
marginalize
to.
You.
Yeah.
In my family, if I tell people we should paint the house green, everybody looks at me sideways. They go to PhD again, thinking he's going to tell everybody what to do. One of my cousins
yeah.
called me, and we were in the cotton field together when we were little boys. He called me after I got the PhD. He said, boy, you are almost white. I said, what? He said, you got that PhD? He said, you're teaching at a university? He said, I saw your car. You got a really nice car. You live in a nice house. He said, you're almost white. That's a cultural critique more than a racial critique. But
yeah.
he's accurate in the way we criticize each other inside our own community.
Yeah, exactly. And how we even value each other and hold each other
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
So there's, exactly. it's very complex. That's why I'm so glad we're able to do these little short ones. Let's try to move down. I want to look at, before we talked a little bit, started moving into race-based trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to expand that some more. And maybe even connect it to some of the things we've been talking about with this show as far as being alienated in schools and different things like that. All of those, even watching the news, can be traumatizing for all of us. But there's, I think, a specific trauma that's specifically part of being in communities where you are not valued as much as your next door neighbor, or you're even told you're not welcome, not valued.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my thoughts, and I want to know yours about race-based trauma. How do you see it playing out now? What do you think has contributed to it in the past? And how can we first recognize it in ourselves and so that we can move out and help others?
If you consider that race and racism was one of the foundational pillars of American society, it's really, really difficult to imagine America without racism.
Yeah.
Because the hierarchy of America was created around the ideas of race.
Yeah.
So that being white was the privilege. You get born, you hadn't done anything to gain privilege. You get born, you hadn't done anything to lose privilege. But if you were born white in a white supremacist, white dominated society like America, you are born with a certain privilege that you don't have to earn.
Yeah.
Same thing is true for men in terms of gender. You know, being born a man in a male-dominated society. Look at the figures. Look at the numbers. Men
mm-hmm.
are not that much more or less intelligent than women, but the numbers make it look like men are just superhuman compared to women when it comes to any kind of achievements.
Yeah.
And so race has operated the same way. So children learn very early. My granddaughter is flat-out genius. She has been ever since she's been in the world. She made it to fourth grade, I think.
Yeah, I know.
She made it to fourth grade. And she came home one day and told her mom, I'm not as smart as the white boys.
Oh, wow.
Now, I guarantee you, nobody told her that with their mouth. But through the context of being in classroom after classroom after classroom, this very brilliant child concluded that she was not as smart as the white boys.
Mm.
And that's devastating when you realize that the context is teaching our children these lessons at the same time as we try to teach them that they are competent and capable. Society suggests that they are not smart, they are not beautiful, they are not good, all of those things. And for a lot of the boys I work with, little boys of color, I had one school at kindergarten. Two teachers came to me and said one little boy, they were worried about him because they thought he was going to be a gangster.
What?
At kindergarten. And I'm like, gangster? God. Why do you say gangster? Well, he plays so hard on the playground, he hates to lose, and he'll fight people. And, I mean, if that little boy gets that message for first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, by seventh, eighth grade, what is he going to think he is?
A gangster.
A gangster. And yeah. We wonder how children learn these ideas about who they are. The research shows that expectancy theory says that a child will perform to whatever standards you expect them to in most cases, or mm-hmm. they will perform down to whatever standards you expect them to. Mm-hmm. Here's a high school example. One of my brightest young men. I mean, he's a little character. He used to be in trouble when I would go visit school, but every time I would ask somebody for the meaning of a word, he would spit it out without even having to think about it. He's such a bright mm-hmm. young man, but making all bad grades now. And teachers had high expectations for students. I asked the whole group. He was the first one to answer. No, they don't.
Mm.
I'm like, why not? He says, because they don't. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, I took my math test. And he says, I made a C. And he said, a teacher told me that was a pretty good grade. And that I'd, be able to pass the class with a C. I said, why was that low expectation? He says, Dr. Lake, I should have made an A on that test, but the teacher didn't expect me to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how subtle is that? Go ask the teacher, does he have low expectations for that kid? What will that teacher likely say?
No, not at all. He's doing really well.
No, I praised him. I told him he did good for making a C.
Yeah.
When in fact, he should have been expecting the kid to make an A.
Or trying to find out why he wasn't making the A if he didn't.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And
the kid knew that the teacher did not expect him to make an A and probably didn't put that much energy or effort into the test.
Yeah, he probably said, why bother? I can knock it out and go on and play, with my friends and
go stuff. Go play video games or go hang out with my friends or whatever. And that's where a lot of teachers are. They feel sorry for the kids. And I get that a lot with kids of color and poor kids. Oh, his brother got arrested for dealing drugs, so, we are giving him a little space. And I told him, I said, if I went home and told my daddy I didn't do my schoolwork because one of my friends got arrested for dealing drugs, could you go home and tell your daddy that he landed?
No. No.
Oh, no. No. And so there's a systemic deficit cultural perspective of children of color and poor children. And we make excuses at the systemic level for them not doing well in school. And I think it's as much to cover our failure as it is to actually help the child.
And deal with some of the difficult things that these kids are facing. One of which, and I'm sure you ran into this as well, is pure D boredom. When you're in classrooms that don't expect you to do and reach for the highest you have, you get – I was bored out of my mind in school because there was nothing to speak of in the classroom that I hadn't already pretty much run into. This was in grade school and high school. Run into in my reading at home as a kid or – run into just sitting around the dinner table, listening to my mother and father talk about politics, all kinds of stuff. And that is another thing that I think teachers, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, they don't want to admit that the bottom line for these different classes are boring as hell for any kid who had any kind of guidance and people in the home.
Yep.
that causes kids to act out. What do we do as adults when we're bored? I'm bored. I'm going to go, let's see, what can I do? You know? And you got this kid with all his energy in the classroom. And so sit down and go read this paragraph, and they read it in a half a minute. And there they are, twiddling their thumbs and bored out of their minds. Yep. So there's that, too. And I don't think we talk about that much. I don't think we talk about it.
The burden on teachers is incredible. You know,
it is.
Very good teachers. I mean, we still use the same model of education we used in 1895.
Yeah.
We put 20 or 30 kids in one room. We put one person as the only resource, and we expect that one person to be able to meet the needs of 30-plus children in many cases. And I'll ask, teach, special needs children do you need in your classroom to disrupt your whole classroom? They said one.
One.
I had one.
It takes one.
Dr. Lake, I got 6 special needs students in my classroom. And they don't have other resources. And so the system has to change. I mean, we are past the days of one person being the expert in the room and delivering information and knowledge to everybody else. Our children have access to information the same as we do nowadays.
Yeah.
And to create effective learning opportunities, we can't just use that same old model of one teacher as the resource. We have children who are facing drug issues, alcohol issues. In fact, I asked my teacher class when we first started, how many of you teachers are alcohol abuse counselors? Nobody. How many are drug abuse counselors? Nobody. How many are sex abuse counselors? Nobody. How many are physical violence abuse counselors? Nobody. I said, guess who you're going to have in your class this year? Children who are dealing with drug abuse, alcohol abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, and you are expected to be there. Resource? You haven't had training for any of that. And if you can't access other resources to help with that, you will fail. Which I've had teachers quit after the first year, second year, third year. I can't do this, Dr. Lake. Too much. I can't help all the children in my class.
Yeah, I tried teaching as well, and my hat's off to teachers, the ones who stick in there and stay and keep coming back. I couldn't do it either. It was heartbreaking because you can see it on these little kids' faces, the pain and I just couldn't do that. It was just too much.
No,
but I highly regard teachers. Part of why I'm doing this is this one in particular is because I want people to hear that our teachers need that kind of support that you're bringing forward, that you're highlighting, that kind of support they need. They don't have to know how to do it or know how to counsel particular aspects like alcohol abuse, but at least have the support that where they can send and get information or give information to these to their students.
Absolutely. And a teacher, I tell all of my students, in order to remain a good teacher, you have to also be a learner.
Yeah.
And then the moment you stop learning, you should also probably stop teaching.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
No, the dynamics of what's happened in schools is that our society has pushed off a lot of the issues that used to be dealt with in treatment centers or in intensive treatment situations for children. I used to be a therapist. I was a child therapist for 11 years. And each child would have a doctor assigned, a psychiatrist, a nurse, and a primary therapist. And the primary therapist would have a therapist supervisor that they could confer with. And so you had what probably should be considered a true medical model of service for kids who needed the most support and help. But those programs went away, got defunded, deinstitutionalized a lot of the institutions. So that a lot of the homeless people we see now are people who used to be helped in our mental institutions. And so for a lot of the children that we have now, they're not in those treatment centers. They're in your classroom. I tell my teachers, they're in your classroom. And if you think that you can be the resource for them alone, you're making a mistake. You have to ask your administrator for help. You need to have the social service people help. You need to have the police agencies everybody we can get to help with a lot of situations that our children and our families are facing.
Yes, exactly. You put it so clearly, very clear. And that's what I love about you. You take these difficult things and bring clarity to it. So let's move on to race-based trauma historically, because I'm gonna share a little bit of a struggle that I'm dealing with right now, which is I'm very interested in. I feel like I have to watch these cases. Just this morning, I was watching the prosecution for Aubrey get final closing, and it breaks my heart. It does, but I also feel like I need to experience that, because
yes,
I can't imagine the family sitting there and listening to some of the things that comes out.
No.
So I don't want to focus on it, but one thing that keeps popping out in my head is it falls under this race-based trauma, where you have generation after generation after generation of people based on how they look or where they live or whatever. And I'm not talking about alcoholism or anything like that per se. Those are fallouts. I'm talking about downright living a horror story trauma, where we have people who are generational in as far as experiencing their family lynching people and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm coming from the point of being a chaplain. I was a chaplain for years in high trauma hospitals and clinics. And one of the stories that stuck out with me real quick was this guy was, he was terminal, and he was in the hospital. He wasn't coming home. And I was his pastoral care person. And he was okay, you know, but one day he was just crying and crying and crying and wouldn't talk. He said, and then after a couple of days of that, he wouldn't talk. And after talking a lot, he finally said, I said, "What's going on?" And he said, I've been thinking about my best friend. And he said, it's been so long since I've seen him, and I'm wondering how he is. I don't know anything, whether he's still alive. And I don't have much time, so I was just thinking about him, and I wish I had kept contact with him. Now, mind you, he has lived his life. He's on his pretty much deathbed, right? And he's thinking about this friend. So I said, well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about your friend. Tell me about him. And he told me, and it turned out this was back in grade school. He had his best friend, and he said, we did everything together. We loved each other, and we were so – and I'm thinking I was thinking maybe high school or college, but grade school. Even he said, even we went to school, first day of school together. And he said one day his father told him that he couldn't be friends with his friend anymore. And I said, oh. And my mind jumped, and I tried to stop it, but my mind jumped to maybe he was you know, gay, and they found out or something. He wasn't. His friend was black, and he was white. And that his father told him, I don't want you bringing any niggas here, talking about you getting married.
Oh, my.
And he said, and this is after not saying anything to him about his friendship. And he said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. He refused and got the crap kicked out of him more than once, until he finally gave in. And that was what he was thinking. It wasn't religion.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't, I wish I had $1 million. It wasn't even his family, per se.
Wow.
It was that loss, that first trauma of losing your best friend and having to get beat beaten, right? More than once,
mm-hmm.
to submit.
Wow.
So I think that we are dealing with white-identified people, black-identified people, and everything in between who have this trauma that's based on race that is a bogus, we've already talked about that, a bogus
mm-hmm.
category.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? I have a ton of thoughts, but I want to hear from you.
Well, Frederick Douglass was one of the first to identify the damage suffered by the slave owner as well as the damage suffered by the slave.
Exactly, yes.
That slavery was as horrendous or maybe more horrendous in its results and outcomes, impacts and effects on the white people who owned color and treated them like animals and lynched people and raped women and all of the things that they did under the cover of law. This is one mm-hmm. of the conversations I had when somebody told me, well, it was legal what Rittenhouse did. I said, yeah, but slavery was legal. Y'all remember? Slavery was legal. You going to tell me it was right? No. Mm-hmm. Jim Crow mm-hmm. was legal. All the lynchings that happened during the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s that were never any consequence, they were legalized. I mean, mm-hmm. all of the discriminations of this society have been by law. Otherwise, they wouldn't have such effect. Individuals can discriminate, but when whole societies discriminate, it's an incredible impact on the whole society, not just on the people who are discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
I think all oppression dehumanizes the oppressor as well as the oppressed in a different way,
yes.
for sure, but in an ugly way, so that the violence in this society cannot be disconnected from the violence that's been practiced against people of color from the beginning of this society.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely couldn't stay like what happened with Native Americans. It can only be classified as a genocide, but how much do we talk about it? How much
yeah.
do we take ownership for it? What happened to African Americans is one of the worst tragic historical events in American society. But you see people who are trying to refuse to have us even learn about these things.
Mm-hmm.
My answer says you can't get past your history unless you own it.
Mm.
You know, what we are doing is avoiding the real ownership of these issues so that we can get past them. Each generation
has
these things on.
That's
each generation
happening.
Will pass these things on, and that's why we still are. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, I do it with my groups. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin were pretty racist. They thought buying and selling people was okay. Everybody agreed. They were pretty sexist. They created a country and they told their mothers that they couldn't vote, told their wives, mm-hmm. told their sisters. Didn't even make it possible for their daughters to vote because they never saw women as being citizens. They didn't include white men, even if they were white and male, if they were poor. They didn't get
they
to go work on the Declaration of Independence or Constitution. They were outside, too. So racist, sexist, and classist. Then I asked the audience, I said, how many people know they're dead? And people laughed mm-hmm. a little bit. I said, yeah, they're dead. They've been dead for hundreds of years. But here we are in 2021 still having this struggle with what kind of issues?
Same.
Racism,
yeah.
sexism, classism. So it must be every generation since those men were alive, what have we retaught to the new people coming up in this society? Racism, sexism, classism, now homophobia, ableism, all of these other issues. And we continue to reteach those things. This is why education is at the core of this work as well, of what people are trying to prevent our children from learning is exactly what our children should learn.
Exactly. I know.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are against it as well would benefit. It makes me a little on the crazy side, but I'm not crazy. It just really irritates me to think about people doing the same stuff over and over and not getting anywhere, and we're still dealing with the same stuff over and over and teaching it to a new generation, and they're incorporating it in a way that we can't predict. You know, we don't know because they're a whole new generation. They have a perspective of their own, and we're taking their innocence, which is what we really need. We need that innocence in ourselves and in the next generation to be able to see beyond the craziness that, for instance, is being aired on our television and in the courts right at this minute. where you have this, I'm going to be a little politically incorrect. I can do that. It is my show. You have this deer in headlight looking guy wondering, how did I get into trouble? Why am I in trouble? Look, that's how he looks. You know, like, mm-hmm. what is going on? I didn't do anything. And he literally shot a man with a big-ass gun mm-hmm. on the street for nothing, just for running. And he's sitting there looking like, I don't understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of stuff we're still dealing with, huh? Pardon me?
Well, they dressed him up as if he was a child. They should have showed him pictures of when he had his hat backwards with the gun around his chest, acting like he was Rambo. No, they got to look like a 12-year-old boy up there crying, talking about he didn't mean to shoot people when he shot an unarmed man four times.
Yeah.
Not an accident. And whatever the man was doing, they suggest that they were trying to take his gun so they could kill him. Where did that come from?
It didn't.
None of those people were trying to kill him. They were trying to stop him from killing other people.
Yeah, Windhouse, he did a squirrel maneuver. That's what I call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where the squirrel sees the dog, and he's in the fence, in the yard, sniffing around, scratching his ass, and he goes and pops his head up. And says, they make a noise.
Yep.
And the dog says, makes a beeline barking.
Yep.
That's what I see when I see what happened at that protest.
Yep.
This little guy, and I think he was very well coached by legal.
Oh my goodness,
to have to be able to slip through.
I mean, all of the crying was a coaching situation. They don't usually put anybody on the stand.
They've been
convicted of that. I mean, accused of killing. They try to protect him from being cross-examined, but they put him up there on purpose so he could break down with that fake crying.
Yeah, and you can see him looking around, just very quickly looking to see who's looking at him when he's crying, all hysterically, quote unquote. Yeah, so that's the dilemma that I'm not sure will be even addressed before my generation is gone and my grandkids are dealing with it, the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep, mine are too. I'm having to deal with a school district right now about one of my grandchildren.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've noticed with grandkids, now my daughters, they are, you know, doing their thing as far as
mm-hmm.
processing how they were brought up. Actually, I learned some stuff about them around race after they got into adulthood, and it was surprising. But because they didn't talk about it, they just processed it themselves. But now, mm-hmm. what one of my daughters is doing is private teaching. She's not in school at all. I'm not sure how that will work, but it is a response if you have that option. Most people don't. Well, anything you want to add as we move out?
Well, the cost of racism is incredible on this society, past and present. And if America can't let go of race and racism as the markers of people's place in American society, we will pass this on to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. Because scientifically, biologically, and genetically, there's only one race. As we began this conversation, my skin color doesn't tell you how smart I am or how competent I am or how good I am at anything. To use race, the socially constructed racial categories, as a means of organizing, hierarchizing your society is so flawed at this point that there's no way it can continue in a healthy society, helping produce a healthy society. Every time race and racism shows up in these conversations, it's going to be dysfunctional.
Yeah. And cause more trauma, which will cause more trauma.
Yes. I mean, you see it in some of our littlest children. I mean, guess who gets out? Guess who gets put out of school more often than kindergarten? I mean, I laugh about it, but it's not funny at all. But the disparity in the suspension rate of black boys at kindergarten is outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're kindergartners. They're kindergartners. Yeah. Landers, they are little babies.
I know.
But
yeah.
They're targeted already at kindergarten. What do you think is supposed to happen by the time he's 10th, 11th grade? And where my grandson is. I mean, this one white boy started videotaping my grandson. And my grandson says, what are you doing? He says, well, I got me one.
Oh.
And my grandson is like, what? He says, I got me one. And my grandson got up and walked out of the class. Teacher didn't even notice it. Teacher didn't say anything about it. Other kids went to the principal and told him what happened. Then they started reacting, responding to it. But this was weeks ago. Like I told somebody yesterday, I said, if somebody had broke their arm, would you attend to it 2 weeks later?
Yeah.
Or would you attend to it immediately? So this kind of racial trauma for kids of color, do you attend to it immediately or do you put it off for 2 or 3 weeks till you figure out how to dance your way around it?
Put your heads together.
No,
yeah.
Your response needs to be immediate if you intend to really do something about a traumatic issue that a child has suffered. 2 or 3 weeks later, coming back.
How do we cover our ass?
Yeah, we can't tell you what we did, but we did something. Now, how does that help the child? We can't tell you what we did, but we did something.
Oh, my God.
That don't help the child at all. And then when he punches somebody in the mouth after 2 or 3 of those experiences, then everybody wants to say, what's wrong with black boys? And I told him, I'm not having that. And I told my grandson, I said, you were a better kid than I was. You walked away from it. I said, I probably would have knocked his teeth down his throat first. Then who would be the victim, Elandis? Who would be the victim?
Well, That's another squirrel episode.
Yeah, the squirrel thing. Yeah, the boy who instigated would then be seen as the victim.
Crying and,
Yep. Which is where a lot of our kids end up because they have tolerated this stuff so much that their first reaction is to punch somebody.
God, that's, we gotta keep doing stuff with this.
Yes. I look forward to the next conversation. It seems like time goes too fast when we get started.
I know, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, my friend.
Okay. All
thank
right.
you again. And
thank you.
Until next time.
We'll talk soon.
Yes.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's all I have today. Until next time.
Thank you for listening. This has been Illusion of Difference, I as Creator, with your host, Elandis Lake. Join us again. Continue to learn how to take charge in every situation, every challenge.